Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 352, I chat with Kaushik Sundar, research scientist at OSSIC, about how we hear in 3D. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded May 4th, 2017, episode 352, Immersive Hearing. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Kaushik Sundar, research scientist at a company called OSSIC, which is a maker of a really interesting 3D immersive headphone, which we're going to be talking about during the show. Hey, Kaushik, welcome to the show.
Hey, pleasure to be on your show, Scott.
Those of you who are tuned live to live.twit.tv can join the chat room there, or you can join at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. It always helps if you put my screen name in the message, which is my name, Scott Wilkinson, no dots or dashes. That way it'll appear on a different color on my screen and I'll be able to see it more easily. So Kaushik, let's begin with what is your background in terms of, your title is research scientist, which really could mean anything.
Yep.
What is it that you research and how did you get into it?
I started with engineering. I'm an electrical engineer. I did my electrical engineering back in India in one of the universities. It's called NITK. And then after that, I went to Singapore. I did my PhD in 3D audio. So
you can actually get a PhD in 3D audio.
It's essentially in the School of Electrical and Electronics Engineering, but the lab that I was working on was primarily working on audio signal processing. I was working on 3D audio stuff. Before that, earlier during my undergrad, I was in Germany in one of those really amazing labs. It was called the Technical Institute of Communication Acoustics. That was in TU Dresden, and they were doing some incredible research in audio signal processing, especially psychoacoustics. And that's where it all began. But I've always been a musician right from my childhood, so music has always been there.
So, well, you know what? You and I have very similar backgrounds then, because I have been a musician most of my life, long before I was involved in science or technical stuff.
That's essentially the driver, you know. Music, you want to know more about audio, the sounds, the science behind sound.
Exactly. Physics, I have a degree in physics, and my physics thesis was on the acoustics of woodwind instruments. And I also developed a curriculum for a class on psychoacoustics. So we have a lot of commonality here. So happy to have you on the show.
Very happy to be here.
Let's start with, after that, I should say, let's go to the basics of human hearing, because after all, that's where we have to start, or that's where things happen, is in our heads as stimulus comes into the ear. So let's start with that. So the ear basically is divided into three sections, and we have a graphic to show this.
Yeah, is a graphic coming up?
Yeah, I think it should be momentarily.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, so essentially you can see this outer ear, the pinna, and then you have the middle ear, which is essentially a canal, you know, a ear canal. It's an auditory ear canal. And then the auditory ear canal terminates at the eardrum, which is also called as the tympanic membrane. And then after that, you have these three tiny bones, the malleus, incus, and the stapes is also this, it's also called as the hammer, anvil, and the stirrup. So these are in fact, the three tiniest bones in our human body.
Isn't that amazing?
That's just incredible. And, you know, so it's what it's essentially doing is it's as the sound waves travel through your ear canal and hits the eardrum, these three tiny bones, they act as the medium, you know, it transfers the energy from the eardrum to the inner ear, that's the cochlea, and which is where you have this basilar membrane. It's a liquid medium, and it's
coiled up in the cochlea, which we see there, which yes. is part of the inner ear. Looks kind of like a snail.
Yeah, it's very tiny. In fact, if you unwrap it, it's like, you know, it's like 30 to 40 millimeter. Yeah. So yeah, and think about it. I mean, within this small membrane there, you have these really tiny hair cells arranged in the order of frequencies. So whatever the frequency that enters the ear canal, hits the eardrum, goes through these three tiny bones to the into the cochlea, and so those particular frequencies are actually actuated. And then it sends as a nervous impulse to the auditory cortex.
Right, into the brain.
Yeah, into the brain. It's yeah. I mean, what we just explained is like is a very noob way to explain it. It's very very complicated.
Yeah.
The other three semicircular canals that you see. That is more for the balance.
Right.
So yeah, it's connected to your eyes and how when you're traveling, it's yeah, that's what makes sure you're completely balanced, you know.
Right, exactly. And if you feel dizzy or something, it might possibly be something wrong in there. I find that also the semicircular canals to be quite amazing. In that they basically form a three-dimensional orientation so that as you move your head, you can tell where you are in space and how you're oriented because of yes. those three canals.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, really, yeah, really astonishing. I've always been fascinated by that, yeah. The other point I want to make about that before we leave that graphic is the three tiny bones, the malleus, incus, and stapes, or hammer, anvil, and stirrup. The last one, stirrup, because of the way that the stapes is shaped. It looks kind of like a stirrup on a horse. Those three together are known as the ossicles.
Yep.
And I wanted to ask you right up front, the company you work for is called OSSIC, O-S-S-I-C.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons.
Because it refers to the ossicles.
The name comes from ossicles. Because yes, they are the three tiny bones and one of the most important aspects of hearing.
Yeah. Boy, it's amazing how that design works. You know, the sound waves come in, hit the eardrum or tympanic membrane. Those three tiny bones vibrate and they transmit the vibration from one to the other.
Yes.
And then finally, what's called the oval window at the entrance to the cochlea vibrates, and then that causes the fluid inside. I mean, it's so complex. It's amazing.
It's extremely complex. It's extremely complex. I mean, it's a lot of chemistry, the fluids there, the a lot of neuroscience involved too. So it's a very very complicated subject there, right?
Yeah.
There.
So. After we understand that, we need to understand something called the head-related transfer function, or HRTF.
Yep.
And explain what that is and why it's important.
Yeah, I mean, head-related transfer function is just a term. So what head-related transfer function explains is how you it defines how you localize sounds. So it's basically like a transfer function that, you know, right from the sound source until your eardrum. So it's just that transfer function. So every position in the space has a particular HRTF. So that's how it is. So and every and, individual,
and each of us individually has a certain HRTF.
Each of us. So these, I mean, you have learned your own ears right from your childhood. Right from your childhood, you've been listening to sounds. You've been able to localize different sounds. So you have learned that. It's a learning process, and that's how you localize sounds. And for every direction, there's a certain pattern of frequencies that's formed in the eardrum, which you are totally familiar with, you know, subconsciously, because your brain is doing all the processing. As soon as it senses that pattern at the eardrum, it goes and matches it to that particular location. And then, you know that, hey, the sound is coming from this particular direction. So
I'm sorry. We're going to take the graphic slightly out of order here. I want to look at graphic number 3 first. Mm-hmm. Which illustrates how different the spectral response is depending upon where the sound is coming from.
Yeah, I mean, totally. So every particular angle in this entire 3D space, if you see these three curves, they are the frequency responses at the eardrum, right? So you, for all these different angles, the frequency responses, spectral responses are completely different. Mm-hmm. And it's and all these patterns you see, the notches and the peaks, they're all because of these really tiny cavities in your ear.
Yeah.
So in your pinna, the external ear, these very tiny cavities. So they sound goes hits these cavities, undergoes reflections and refractions and diffractions, and that's why you get these notches and peaks.
Mm-hmm. And that what we're looking at here is for one particular person, this person whose ear we're looking at.
Yes.
But each of us, you, me, everybody, each person in the world has a different set of these spectral responses. And the primary reason is, as we can see from graphic number 2, which is everybody's got a different ear.
Yeah, I mean, our human ears are also known as an acoustic fingerprint. They are as unique as fingerprints. So since the ears, as you can see in this image, right, every human ear, they have different cavity volumes, the size of the ear, everything is different. And all these things make a big impact on the frequency responses at the eardrum. So, and that's why these HRTFs are so different for every year.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, graphic number 4 gives us a sense of how the response differs between different people.
Yeah, I mean, so if you see all these subject 131, 133, 144, these are HRTFs taken from a very commonly, very famous public database. It's called the CIPIC database. So they have HRTFs available open source for a different set of ears, and all these different blue curves for a particular subject are HRTFs of different angles in the azimuthal plane, like minus 60 to like plus 60 degrees. So
the azimuthal plane, is that the horizontal plane or the vertical plane?
It's the horizontal plane. So minus 60 degrees to plus 60 degrees.
So that would be off to your left versus off to your right or whatever.
Yeah. And what you immediately notice is between these subjects, the high frequencies are so different from each other. And you cannot really predict them unless and until you actually measure them.
Hmm. Because the ears are so, those cavities and those little folds and what have you are so tiny that they can't really be calculated ahead of time?
I mean, unless you have these really high resolution ear images or 3D scans of the ear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way of doing it. If you have these, there's one other graphic there where we have the laser scanning method.
Oh, yes. We can take a look at that. That is, that's kind of later, I think. That is number, I'll tell you in a minute here. Yeah, number 6. Yeah. There it is.
So, I mean, there is this way where, you know, you can actually scan your head, the ears, take really high resolution mesh images, 3D mesh images, and then you can calculate these HRTFs numerically using, you know, there are different numerical techniques by a boundary element method and, you know, finite element methods. So with this, you can estimate the HRTFs for different locations, but you really need a very, very, very high resolution 3D image, scan image for this. And also, it's computationally very, very expensive.
Computationally expensive?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you don't have high resolution laser scans and a lot of computational power to calculate that way, you can do it the old-fashioned way by simple measurement. Not so simple, but we have graphics 5.
Yeah.
Graphic 5 to show how it actually would be done without high-resolution laser scans and so on. Here it is. Tell us what we're looking at.
This is like the most common method of measuring HRTFs. I mean, it looks simple, but it's actually a very, very tedious process. So what we are looking at is these two universities where they have these really amazing anechoic chamber, especially the ISVR Southampton. So you see that there's a listener seated in the center, and there is this dome of speaker around him.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these dome of speakers can move up and down, and from each speaker there's a certain angle. They first hear these sine sweeps. So, I mean, note that they have these really tiny probe microphones in their ear. So they have these microphones in their ear that's actually recording these impulse responses, HRTFs, for every location.
Right. Now, Undermind in the chat room is pointing out that in that previous diagram with all the different HRTFs, one of them is called Keymar.
Yeah.
And he's pointing out that that's the dummy head.
Yes, exactly. The dummy head, the Keymar is the dummy head. And I mean, just to show that the dummy head that people commonly use is one of the dummy heads is the Keymar head. And you see that how different that is to the actual human ears.
Right. And we see graphic 7 has several dummy heads that show us you can calculate HRTF on one of these, but it doesn't correspond to any particular person.
Yeah, I mean, these are made with an intention that it's a generalized human ear. It's more like a standard. I mean, BNK has, the first one is the BNK HATS. Then there is Neumann head, and there is head acoustics head. They're different people have come up with these different set of dummy heads that they have, you know, they are, they use it more like a standard.
Mm-hmm. Or an average, shall we say?
Yeah, it's more like an average. And here is the thing, it doesn't match really well to any particular set of human ears. I mean, mm-hmm. someone would have a ear similar to those heads, but then, yeah, it's...
Somebody
it's,
else it's wouldn't.
Not, yeah, most wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I see on some of these dummy heads, there's also some torso involved. Mm-hmm. And that actually brings me to a question from May the 4th, mm-hmm. which, by the way, happy Star Wars Day to everybody. May the 4th
happy Star Wars.
Be with you. The question is, does the size of the nose also matter? And I would add to that, what about the shoulders and the torso and the upper part of the body?
So shoulders and torso does matter because, I mean, in the horizontal plane, it doesn't matter that much. But it makes a big difference in the vertical plane, especially in the near field. So as the sound source is, you know, coming towards you as within a distance of 1 meter, the shoulder and torso reflections become very important. But in the horizontal plane, in the far field, it's fine. I mean, you can these reflections can be generalized and modeled. You don't need really individualized reflections for these. But in the, as I said, in the elevation plane, it does make a big difference. And coming to a question on how important is a nose.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't think anyone has studied that, but I would assume that it doesn't have that big of an effect.
Okay.
Of course, you need it for your smell, but
yeah, right.
I don't think it makes that difference for hearing.
For the HRTF, right.
Yeah.
User 9524 is asking, do ears change shape over age, over time, as you age?
I mean, it does. I mean, of course, as you grow, your ears does change. It the size increases, right?
As you go from a child into an adult,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it does increase. And you learn this aspect. You learn how your HRTF is changing with time and everything. Your brain does all that. It's
right.
A learning
automatically.
Process.
You don't even think about it. It just happens.
You don't think about it. You don't think about that. Your legs are, you know, getting longer and longer as you grow. It's just like that. So you don't really think about that consciously. It happens.
So we have one more graph to show in this regard, and that's an anechoic chamber. And we've talked about this on the show more than once, but I wanted to give people a sense of what it really looks like. It's quite an amazing place. Why don't you explain what we're looking at here and why anechoic chambers are important?
So anechoic chambers are really, really important to get, you know, very good set of acoustical measurements. I mean, it ranges whether you are doing a HRTF measurement or, you know, just calibrating speakers, you need anechoic chambers. And the interesting thing is they don't have reflections, right? It's completely anechoic. So
meaning no echoes.
No,
or
echoes.
No reflections.
No reflections. And I mean, these pointed, you know, structures that you see, these are made up of glass fibers. And they're very, very, and the gaps in between, they work more as bass traps. So, I mean, you really don't have any reflection. And in fact, if you stay there for a really long time, you could actually feel nauseated. I mean, you'll literally start listening to your own heartbeats and blood circulation. It's a creepy place to be in if you're staying for a long time. And what you see in this image is basically there's again a HRTF measurement with a dummy head.
Right. I have to tell you, I've been in anechoic chambers before, not for very long. But I have always wanted to try meditating in one. I don't know if you've ever tried that or not.
No.
But it could be weird. You might not be able to focus, but removing all acoustic or audio things in your environment might be able to let you dig deeper into the meditative state. I don't know. I want to try it sometime.
Yeah, but it's just that weird state. It actually demonstrates very well how important is reflections. I mean, in our real life, you have reflections everywhere. Sound hits the wall, and you listen to these reflections. You don't really realize it, but then these reflections are so important in building that ecosystem for sound, right? So.
Right.
Yeah, it's very, very crucial, very critical.
Yeah, Undermind and Emily the Strange, both in the chat room, are likening it to sensory deprivation.
Totally, yeah.
In this case, it's only the sound, but there are sensory deprivation tanks where you can lie in water, super salty water, so you're very, very buoyant. And I haven't tried one of those either, but I do want to, so... That's kind of cool, but it's weird. It's a weird feeling when you're in there. There's no doubt about that.
Yes, it is. It is.
But it does give you the opportunity to make these very good HRTF measurements. And we saw in one of the previous pictures of a person sitting in an anechoic chamber with a dome of speakers basically around them, calculating the HRTF for that individual.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, I mean, So what's the thing is it takes a long time to do these heads RTF measurements, and that's one drawback of actually doing these individualized acoustical measurements. So it also depends on how stable can this listener sit, right? I mean, he shouldn't be moving his head, so the angles would be messed up. And if it's in the near field due to acoustic parallax, a small error is actually equivalent to a larger error in angle. So yeah, it's a very tricky thing to do these acoustical measurements there.
Emily the Strange is saying, let's have an HTG field trip to a sensory deprivation clinic. I like that idea. We'll do that. Okay, now actually, somebody here in the chat room, UJ, brought up the sort of next point that I want to cover, which is binaural recording. And his question is the difficulty of binaural recording, really the playback of binaural recording, due to the difference in people's HRTF? Let's start with what is binaural recording before we answer that question.
I mean, binaural is very simple. It's essentially bias to an auditless hearing, right? So listening with two ears is binaural. And anything that has... So binaural tries to emulate how you naturally listen to sounds in your real life. So how we listen to sounds in our real life is essentially binaural. We have two senses, the two ears.
Right. You could make the argument that that is how we listen to a stereo system, say, with speakers out in the room. And in fact, I've heard people say, hey, we only have two ears, so why would we need more than two speakers? I know that's not...
Yeah. Go ahead. The unique thing about binaural recording is you place microphones in your ear and record the sounds, or in a dummy head's ear. So... it kind of captures all these interesting pinna effects that you have in a HRTF, and that makes the sound very immersive, and you have this out of the head localization when you listen to these binaural recordings. But here is the thing, as the person in the chat room commented, binaural recordings depend a lot on which ears are you listening to these recordings, right? Whether you're, which ears have you recorded these sounds in. And often you get these front to back confusions when you listen to a recording that is not made in your ear.
Right. So basically, a binaural recording is made by putting microphones in your ears or in a dummy head's ears or somebody else's ears. The sound is recorded. The HRTF kind of automatically comes along with that, right? As you record it,
exactly,
because the microphones are in your ears.
Yeah,
but then somebody else listens to it. They have a different HRTF, and the effect may or may not work very well.
Yeah, I mean, so basically, what happens is the person who's listening, he's most familiar with his or her HRTF, who he or she uses in their daily life. But when they listen to a recording that's made in someone else's ear, the brain gets confused whether, you know, those cues are similar, yet it's dissimilar, you know. So it gets confused. It puts the sound back inside the head. There's no... out of the head localization, there's a lot of front back confusions, there's elevation confusion. So it gets totally messed up, especially recordings that depend a lot on, you know, actual directional localization, that where localizing a particular sound source is very critical.
Mm-hmm. And what about listening to a binaural recording, a recording made in this way, on speakers, on a stereo system with speakers? Does that work?
In fact, it does work. It's just that the main idea of binaural is, as you record these sounds with these microphones in your ear, you have to make sure while playing back that the left channel recording has to go only to your left ear and the right channel recording has to go only to your right ear. So, but when you're listening to that on a stereo set of speakers, there is crosstalk. Right, so the left channel also reaches the right ear, and the right channel also reaches your left ear. So that kind of messes it up. So, but you have these really good crosstalk cancellation filters. So if you apply these crosstalk cancellation filters, you can actually listen to a very good binaural perception over speakers, over stereo speakers. And in fact, one of these labs in Princeton, it's called the 3D3A lab. They have designed these set of binaural crosstalk filters. It's called the Bach filters, and I've listened to their demo. It's very impressive.
Mm. May the 4th is also asking, what about ASMR? I don't know that term.
Oh, ASMR is just, you would have definitely listened to these binaural ASMR recordings. I forgot what exactly it stands for, but it's, you have these really creepy sounds, binaural beats. It just, when you listen to them, you just feel meditative and you feel good. It's a different whole different field of recordings. You'll find a lot of binaural ASMR recordings.
Mm. I just looked it up. It's called Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response.
Yes.
Huh. It says, according to Wikipedia here, is an experience characterized by a static-like or tingling sensation on the skin.
Yeah, I mean, there's some recordings that can really be very creepy.
Well, oftentimes I like creepy, you know.
Yeah, now, it's fun.
Speaking of which, you actually provided us with a little musical excerpt of a binaural recording. And I'd like to play it for people, and I think it really would work better if people were listening on headphones.
Oh yeah, you have to listen to it on headphones as well.
Yeah, so tell us what this recording is, and then we'll play it.
So basically this is more like a hobby project of mine that I do a lot of these binaural recordings of ambient sounds, and these are measured just in my ears. But my main idea is this. So as I travel to different places, I truly believe that every place has its own characteristic sound, and you can really capture this well with 3D audio recordings. And mm-hmm. especially for a person who is really familiar with that place, right? Mm-hmm. They don't really need these visual cues. And when they listen to these audio cues, they really feel that they are actually there. And, that's where it really doesn't matter whether I recorded it in my ear or that person's ear, because he's already familiar with that place. He's already there in that place mentally. Mm. So familiarity plays a very, very big role in actually binaural recordings.
Mm, good point.
That's one of the reasons. If you listen to, you would have definitely heard the Smith Realizer. Demos. I mean, they really work well because they have done these measurements in the same room. They play it back in the same room. By then, you are really familiar with that room. And their demo is very, very impressive in that particular room. But the challenge would come really when you listen to the same recording in some other room. And there's like a conflict of these cues.
Cognitive dissonance, it might be called.
Yeah, dissonance.
Cognitive dissonance, yeah. What you're hearing and what you're seeing don't quite jive.
Yeah, that's where I come to this point of familiarity of the place. So when I carry out a recording that's familiar to you, the place is very familiar to you. When I name that place, you're already mentally there. The visual cues are already there. And these auditory cues really gel with them. So, I mean, I've shared it with a lot of people of different places, and it actually makes a big difference. I mean, they instantly feel nostalgic about that place. It's a nice way to, all these are just experimental recordings. And this recording is, this is when I was actually traveling to Indonesia and Bali, and I was in the middle of these rice fields in the night. It was actually a scary experience, and I was hearing really creepy sounds of these frogs and different insects. So I thought it would be a good idea to just go hop in there and record these sounds.
So let's take a listen. This is the MP3 that I sent up to you, Josh.
I think it's actually playing in mono, but
it didn't sound stereo to me. Do we have capability, Josh, or no?
I'm pretty sure I'm hearing it in stereo.
Are you? I'm not.
I'm not. I think Skype doesn't have.
Oh, that may be it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Skype doesn't have.
Okay. But, listening to it on the podcast, then once this gets posted, people should be able to hear a true stereo sound and, pardon me, frogs and bugs and stuff in different locations.
There's a link in SoundCloud. There are different sounds. There are sounds, binaural recordings of the New York subways, and you really feel that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely put the link to the SoundCloud.
It's called Sound Maps Being There. So if you just Google Sound Maps Being There, you will definitely hit the SoundCloud page.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
Then what we're hearing is not representative, you and me, I mean, because we're on Skype.
Yep.
May the 4th, this is very relaxing sound. There's no question about it. User 6327 says, I'm hearing it in stereo. So, I guess if you're on the stream, you're not on Skype, then you will hear it in stereo. And when you download this podcast later and listen to it again, you'll hear it in stereo as well, which is what it should be. May the 4th is asking, how can we tell if it's in stereo or mono? Well, for me, there was not any directionality to the sound.
Yeah, I mean, I could instantly tell the sound is inside your head and
all of it's inside your head.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point of binaural recording, is to have the sounds be outside your head, even if you're listening on, especially when you're listening on headphones. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There it is. Undermine found it. SoundCloud.com/soundmaps_being there, all one word.
Yes.
So, and there are other examples there as well, which I do recommend that people check out, because I myself have done a lot of work in binaural recording, or I did when I was in college, including something called binaural beats, which I'm sure you've studied as well, where you put in a 400 hertz tone into the right ear and a 402 hertz tone into the left ear, and you would, if those were out in the air, you would hear a modulation of 2 cycles per second. Mm. And you'd think, well, if you put one in one ear and one in the other ear totally isolated, how they wouldn't interfere with each other, but they do. They interfere with each other in the brain.
Yeah.
Which is amazing to me. It sounds like a tone kind of going around your head. It's really astonishing.
I mean, how these two ears work in hand with each other is brilliant. In fact, as a fun fact is, when it comes to loudness, right? When you listen to both the ears, the loudness is more or less like double that when you listen to it just with single ear.
Hmm. Well, sorry, you were about to say?
So when what happens is, when people usually listen to earbuds in just one ear, they tend to increase the volume so much, because the brain perceives that the loudness that you perceive is just half of what you're used to listening to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that brings us to another important topic, which is one way that we localize sounds, and it relates to the HRTF, is the difference in level between one ear and the other. Because as you mentioned earlier, if you have two speakers out there, generally speaking, both ears are going to hear both speakers. There's going to be some crosstalk, but there's going to be a level difference between them.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the horizontal plane, what's really important is these ITD and the ILD. That's called the interaural time difference and interaural level difference. Now, how do I know if the sound source is actually to my right? The sound reaches my right ear first and then the left ear. So there is a time difference between the time of arrivals, the time of arrivals between these two ears. And these time of arrivals, the time difference is actually in the order of microseconds. Yes, it's microseconds. So like the longest time difference would be like 700 to 800 microseconds. It's that tiny, and we easily pick up these time differences. That's extremely fascinating, and not just the time difference, but there's also the level difference, right? The sound reaches the right ear first, but then there is this head that's blocking it from reaching the left ear. So, so the head attenuates the sound, so the right ear is like louder it's higher in its deep level across frequencies, than the other ear. So these two level and the time differences are very, very important in localizing sounds in the horizontal plane.
Mm-hmm. Part of that is HRTF, of course, and part of it is kind of the distance between the ears. In other words, how large is your head, so to speak?
How large is your head essentially defines, what's the time, maximum time difference that I can have, and even the level difference. So the head size is important. If you know the head size, you can actually have a good estimation of the ITD and the ILDs of your ear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, HRTF is in general, it encapsulates everything. It encapsulates the ILDs, the ITDs, as well as these spectral cues.
Mm-hmm. Drew Nelson in the chat room, referring back to the little clip we played, I heard stereo, but it sounded like everything happened on a flat plane, that is the horizontal plane. Nothing in front of the head or behind it or above, I would guess. Was that representative of what you heard when you made the recording?
I mean, it is. I mean, there's nothing above my head, but the difference could also be, of course, because these recordings were done in my ear, right?
Right. And his HRTF is different than yours.
Yes. So there could be differences in what you're listening and what I am listening.
Mm-hmm. That's the tough part about all this, isn't it? Recording and it'll work with some people and not with others.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was talking about this familiarity. I have made recordings that are of my hometown and where people are very familiar with these places. And it didn't really matter then when I was doing it in my ear or your ear. So, but if there is a place, if there's a sound that you're not familiar with, where your imagination kicks in, and that's where there is this cognitive dissonance that you are talking about.
You mentioned that you have one recording of like a New York subway.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of recordings from New York. There's a lot of recordings from Seattle. There's some from India. Mm-hmm.
So, when the audience goes to SoundCloud and wants to check some of these out, pay particular attention to ones that are from areas that you're familiar with.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty good advice right there. But that gets us then to, we've been talking about listening in headphones, and headphones offer their own problems, don't they?
Headphones is really convenient. It's the most portable form of listening to 3D or binaural recordings, especially. But then it also presents us with a lot of challenges. Now, again, every headphone is different. We know that. Yeah. And also the fact that headphone responses, so how you measure a headphone responses is again placing these probe microphones in your ear and placing the headphones and playing back tones or sine sweeps or however you want. You measure these impulse responses. And these headphone responses, they are different for every headphone and also for every ear because you're placing it on ears now.
Right, right. Now, I know a lot of people, for example, Tyle Hertzens, who's the editor of Inner Fidelity, he does headphone reviews, and he does headphone measurements on a dummy head, one of those dummy heads we looked at. Yes. He puts the little, you know, the little microphones are in the dummy ears, and he puts the headphones on them, and he puts that all within, a sealed chamber, and he plays those measurements. But that measurement is only really valid for the dummy head, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but it also depends on these headphones. There are headphones that actually work very well across a different set of ears. And these headphones are more or less like diffuse field equalized. That is like more like an average of different ears among different directions. So like if you really go for a high-end Sennheiser headphone, they have a very good diffused field response, and they actually measure pretty much the same for different people.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So, that's the thing. I mean, it makes a big difference on which ear you are listening, placing the headphones. And not just that. I mean, every time you remove your headphone and place it back, you place it in a slightly different position than the previous time. And because of this, all your high frequencies, it's totally different. So repositioning again makes a big impact in headphone measurements. So how we normally measure is we take a multiple set of measurements, removing the headphone, placing it back, removing, placing it back, and then take an average of these measurements.
Ah, that's a good idea. So you do like 10 runs or something. And
that's the best one could do.
Graphic number 10 gives a little illustration of headphone listening and what some of the issues might be.
Yeah. This is like a headphone listening, like, you know, it's a breakdown of headphone listening. So you send some input to the headphones. You have these headphone transducer or the driver, and then you have the ear cup and you have the ear. So this interaction between the ear cup and the ear, you know, this is where the idiosyncratic effects come into picture. This is where it depends on, you know, which ear you are listening to, which ear is it, how it is placed on the ear, how different is the ear. If there are tiny movements here, your high frequencies, you know, about 8 or 10K gets all messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Drew
Nielsen in the chat room is asking or commenting, I tried Dolby Atmos for headphones. It's actually, I think, Dolby Headphone is what it's called. Built into Windows 10, apparently. And the same thing happened that he heard here with this little clip. It felt like a flat plane with nothing in front, behind, or above.
Yeah, I mean, essentially even what Dolby is doing, the Dolby Atmos, Dolby headphones, is they're using a generalized HRTF, right? They're using a generalized HRTF. They have these recordings, different channels for the Atmos setup. They know the angle of the speaker, so they just use these HRTFs. Again, the generalized HRTF that they are using is different to the person listening.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly,
that's where you have these effects.
In a way, the Smith Realizer, which you mentioned earlier, is the ultimate because what it can do is put microphones in your ears.
Yes.
And calculate a real HRTF for you in a particular room with a particular set of speakers.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially goes to the basics of how we talked about, right? We talked about how we actually measure individualized HRTFs. Mm-hmm. In we go to an anechoic chamber and we do these measurements, and they are using it in a real room. What mm-hmm. the more ideal thing for them to do would be is actually if they have your anechoic HRTFs, then they can use that as a base and, you know, have any room layered on top of it.
Oh, that's a good idea. So you could potentially, I mean, you can buy a Smith Realizer. It's like over $3,000 for a box, a little electronic box. But you could take that if you could find an anechoic chamber, take it in there, get an HRTF.
You don't need a Smith Realizer to measure your HRTFs in an anechoic chamber, right? You can do it with any system, any input-output. You have a sound card, you have a good DAC, you have good preamps, you could do these measurements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Huh. Buckmaster in the chat room lives in Seattle. Just listen to the Seattle Transit Tunnel Station clip, and he says, stunning.
Yeah, that's the whole idea. He is familiar with that place so much.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Barfel is asking, what about in-ear monitors?
Uh-huh.
How is that different, or is it?
I mean, it is different, but in a way, it in-ear monitors, if they are really... All these have their own advantages and disadvantages. Again, when you remove the in-ear monitor and place it back, you have the same issue of repositioning, right? The frequencies being different. But I think that the in-ear monitors are slightly more stable. I'm not talking about the in-ear buds. Some really good in-ear monitors that you can actually clip onto your ear, and it's very stable. But if you think about in-ear monitors that actually goes into your ear, it doesn't capture your pinna.
Right.
So repositioning becomes a more prominent differentiated factor there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, getting back to over-the-ear headphones, I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about the Osic X, the product from your company that you've been working on, which addresses many of these issues that we've been talking about in, I think, a very interesting way. So give us an overview of the Osic X.
So, I mean, what Osic X is doing is this is a smart headphone. We have sensors built into the headphone. So as soon as you wear it, it actually captures the head size. That's the first thing it does. And if you know the head size, you can actually get a very good estimate of these ITDs and the ILDs. So that is calibrated to your ear. So it's personalized to your ear.
Your head size.
Your head size, right? And then the headphone is essentially a multi-driver headphone. It has speakers positioned at different locations, and they're strategically positioned such that as they play, it automatically captures your pinna features. So the heart of the system, it's that as well as the way we tune it. So we tune it in such a way that it matches really well with your personalized HRTF. Mm-hmm. And you've heard the demo, it works pretty well.
I'm amazed at how well it works, actually, from the demo that I heard. And I wanted to make sure people understood that you said it has multiple drivers in each ear cup.
Yes.
And more specifically, it's got one in the center of the ear cup. It's got one in front of that main driver, one above and one behind.
Behind, yes.
So that means, and sound coming from any of those drivers interacts with your particular outer ear or pinna.
Yes.
And that sort of automatically takes into account the specific shape of your ear.
Yeah, and the other really important thing, which is not given that much importance in general, is the head tracking. Now, here is the thing. Head tracking is one of the most important things in actually binaural listening. I would say that because now the tiny head movements that we do all the time while listening to sounds makes a huge difference. Now, imagine a sound source to be right at the center. So you don't have ILDs and ITDs now. It's all zero. It's all the same, right? If it's right at the center.
If it's right in front of you.
Yeah, and the spectral cues, if there is a mismatch between the spectral cues between the HRTF and your HRTF. Now, what happens is we often do these tiny head movements. Even a tiny head movement, I would exactly know that the sound source is on the left side of my head and I could pick up the angle. So it's head movements, tiny head movements are very, very important to localize sounds.
And we're extremely sensitive to that.
We are extremely sensitive to that. Yes. So these headphones also have built-in head trackers. So as you move your head, sound source remains at the same position. So ideally, I mean, if you go to a concert, when you turn your head back, the concert remains at the front, right? It doesn't move with you. But normally in headphones, that's what happens. You listen to anything, you turn your head, everything moves with you. So this head tracking makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. In fact, Drew Nielsen was asking this about how about a headset or headphones that measure your individual HRTF and adjust output accordingly? That's exactly what the point of the OSSIC X is, right?
Yes, yes, it is. It is.
Yeah, amazing. Wuka is asking perhaps a bit of a sensitive question. What things does the OSSIC X do better than the Smith Realizer? It's not really a fair question.
I would say it's a different system in general. Smith Realizer is, I mean, this is it is calibrated to your ear, and you can listen to it on any room you want, right? Smith Realizer is, I would say, it's more specific to that particular room because you're measuring these HRTFs in just that particular room.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Smith Realizer, you can use any headphones you want once you have your HRTF, right?
Yes. Yeah. And also that Smith Realizer is $4,000.
Yeah, right. And the OSSIC X, we should say, is not available yet. It's coming out in what, June?
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be like around June, July. Early fall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I just will make sure that everybody knows you can pre-order them now, and the pre-order price is $299, I think.
Yeah.
But if you wait till they're actually available, they're going to be $499. So
yes.
And you know that ain't cheap, but it's not $4,000 either.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea is to give an idea that, you know, such a technology can actually work. I mean, Smith Realizer has done a great job to show the same, and that's precisely what we are also trying to do. It's about this entire ecosystem of 3D audio, the awareness you create to people and build this ecosystem. The more people become aware of it, people will start listening to it, people will start noticing it, people will start demanding it. You know, it's an entire generation. It's that we are trying to, all these 3D audio companies are trying to do. We've been listening to stereo and we have got 3D, really good 3D vision, but audio has been lacking behind. So it's that push that everyone is doing here. And I think that's the main message.
I have to say, I did listen to the demo. You were at the Can Jam last month in LA. And the demo was a virtual reality demo where you put on a Vive headset and the OSSIC X headphones, and you can see objects in the virtual reality space, and you can grab them with the little controller thing and move them around. Each of them basically emits a sound.
Yes.
In fact, part of a larger musical structure, which is kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, I mean, so it was like mixing in space.
mixing in space. So this red thing over here is emitting the bass part, say, and this orange thing over here is emitting the piano part, say, or something along those lines. And you can move them around. And as you move them around the space, maybe you can throw them so they're farther away from you and the level goes down. Or you can bring them in closer and the level goes up. And this one's coming from over here. This one's coming from over there. This one's coming from up above. And as you move your head around, they stay where you put them. So the obvious application for virtual reality and
virtual
for
gaming. Reality. Yes. I mean, it's been, there's a big demand there on the gaming and the VR side. Mm. So yeah, that's going to be driving this 3D audio ecosystem, the VR and the gaming industry.
But there's also movies.
And also movies, yeah.
Movies now have immersive audio as well, right? We have Dolby Atmos, we have DTS:X, we have Auro 3D. So there's three different formats of immersive audio where you have speakers around the room and speakers above, basically. And you have this 3D audio thing. Will the OSIC X also be utilizable for listening to Dolby Atmos soundtracks while you're watching a movie?
It's just about obtaining the licenses from Dolby, the decoder encoders for these, Dolby Atmos specifically. We are not yet in that stage. At any point of time, we could always do that because we have the technology backing it up. So as long as we know the sound locations, we also support ambisonics. That's much more than just, channel based formats. It's like a sound field technology format. So I would say any of these channel based formats or ambisonics format, we have the capability in the headphone that we can do all the processing there.
Except that Dolby Atmos and DTS to a certain extent is not channel based, it's object based.
They're object-based, so we also have object-based features in it. Because essentially the demo that you heard, the VR demo is an object-based demo.
Mm-hmm.
So you have objects floating around different places. You can control individual object separately. So we do have that feature.
My big question, though, is, what, let's assume that at some point you get the Dolby Atmos licensing, so you can implement a decoder. How is the Dolby Atmos bitstream, data stream, going to get to the headphones from, say, a Blu-ray or an Ultra HD Blu-ray or a stream from Vudu or Amazon or something like that? Up till now, what I saw in the demo was the headphones were connected to a computer by USB.
Yes.
But a Blu-ray player, say, or Ultra HD Blu-ray player is going to have an HDMI output.
It's HDMI, yeah.
How do you imagine that's going to work?
We haven't done that yet. We haven't gone to that stage
where we're
actually looking to that. We would be able to have extensions that could take any input and then get into the headphones, route it into the headphones. So we would definitely think about that soon in the near future.
Mm-hmm. But at the moment, there isn't really a way to do that.
At the moment, it's more about the proof of concept that such a technology actually works. I mean, it's already a very complicated headphone. We have a lot of things going on in the headphone. The processing is all going on inside the headphone, the head size calibration, head tracking, and everything. But if you have the content on your PC, you could just plug it in and play it back on the headphones and even on mobile devices.
Right. By the way, out of your head in the chat room, Darren Fong, no doubt, is pointing out that the Smith Realizer MSRP is $2,900, not 4K. So, okay, it's $3,000. Thank you, Darren, for making that correction.
I met Darren at Kanjam. He's a great guy.
Yeah, great guy. In fact, he's going to be on the show in 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
So he's going to be talking about his system, which is also another sort of virtualizer, sound virtualizer of speakers of hearing stuff outside of the headphones. His approach is somewhat different, but also very interesting. So I'm looking forward to talking to him as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and out of your heads, Darren still says, still a lot of money. That's exactly right. It still is a lot of money. okay, so Osic X headphones coming out in June or July, and Osic.com, OSSIC.com is the place to go to learn more and make a pre-order if you want, or just learn more about it. But for now, I want to thank you so much for being here. It's been really great. Really a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. It was fun talking to you.
That's Kaushik Sundar, research scientist at OSSIC. And again, as I said, OSSIC.com is where you can find more information about that. You can always find me at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be David Abrams, a calibrator with whom I worked on evaluating the Sony A1E OLED TV. And he's going to come on the show, and we are going to talk about what we learned as we investigated the Sony OLED, their first large screen, consumer OLED. They make professional OLED broadcast monitors. And you might remember about 8 years ago, they came out with an 11-inch consumer OLED that didn't last very long. But this one looks like it's pretty amazing. So we'll have a lot to talk about then, and I do hope you will join us. Until then... Geek out.